content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, for Xi Jinping, religion is power. As Tibetan Buddhism spreads throughout China, Xi sees an opportunity to consolidate his rule. This is written by Judith Herzog. Shangri-La is best known as a fictional place, an idyllic valley first imagined by a British novelist in the 1930s. But look at a map and you'll find it. Sitting at the foot of the Himalayas in southwestern China, Shangri-La went by a more prosaic name until 2001, when the city was rebranded by Chinese officials eager to boost tourism. Their ploy worked. The star of Shangri-La, is the Ganden Sumsteling Monastery. Since its destruction in 1966, during Mao's Cultural Revolution, this Tibetan Buddhist monastery has been rebuilt into a sprawling complex crowned by golden rooftops and home to more than 700 monks. It was humming with construction when I visited in October and filled with Chinese tourists. Like many monasteries, Sumsteling is thriving thanks to Tibetan Buddhism's growing popularity in China. When the government loosened restrictions on religious worship in the 1990s, the practice took off, especially among urban elites unsatisfied with the Chinese Communist Party's materialistic worldview. It's an open secret that even high-ranking party officials follow Tibetan lamas. Tibetan Buddhism's recent spread presents both a threat and an opportunity for President Xi Jinping. He wants to make China politically and culturally homogeneous, a goal that could be jeopardized by a tradition steeped in Tibetan language and history. But Xi is enacting a program that seeks to turn the rising popularity of Tibetan Buddhism to his advantage. To transform the tradition from a hotbed of dissent into an instrument of assimilation and party propaganda. If it works, it could smooth his path to lifelong power and help him remake China according to his nationalistic vision. Tibetan Buddhism isn't only a spiritual practice, it's an expression of Tibet's cultural identity and resistance to Chinese rule. The Chinese Communist Party annexed Tibet in 1951, claiming that the then independent country belonged to historical China and had to be liberated from the Dalai Lama's Buddhist theocracy. The Dalai Lama fled to India to establish a Tibetan government in exile, and Tibet has been a source of opposition to Beijing ever since. According to the Tibetan scholar Donhap Rekchon, Xi's ultimate goal is to erase Tibet's language and cultural identity entirely. In a campaign similar to the CCP's oppression of the China's Uyghur Muslims, Tibetan teachers and writers have been arrested as, quote, separatists for promoting the Tibetan language, and more than 1 million Tibetan children have been sent to boarding schools to be assimilated into Chinese culture. Xi's effort to control Tibetan Buddhism is just one piece of this long-standing effort to suppress Tibetan identity. But it has taken on an additional valence as the practice expands in China. To co-opt Tibetan Buddhism popularity, the CCP recruits religious leaders willing to implement what it calls Sinicized Buddhism, a combination of state-sanctioned religious teachings and socialist propaganda taught by party-approved clergy, and rewards their monasteries with money and status. The well-funded Sumsteling Monastery, for example, has been officially designated by the CCP as a, quote, forerunner in the implementing of the Sinification of Buddhism. To detach Buddhism from Tibetan culture, monks are pressured to replace traditional Tibetan language scriptures with Chinese translations. According to Rakeshon, they will soon be expected to practice in Mandarin. The approach is part of a broader campaign to influence all religions in China. As of January 1st, every religious group is legally required to carry out patriotic education and enhance the national awareness and patriotic sentiments of clergy and believers. Failure to pledge loyalty to Xi, display the Chinese flag, and preach patriotic sentiments is now punishable by law. If Mao wanted to eliminate religion, Xi wants to nationalize it. Co-opting Tibetan Buddhism will bring Xi one step closer to achieving what he and the CCP call the Chinese Dream, a vision that seeks to unite China's ethnic groups, its Han majority, Tibetans, Uyghurs, Mongolians, and dozens more, in their dedication to the motherland and party. Xi has already consolidated more political power than just about any other modern leader, but realizing the Chinese dream will require something arguably more difficult, winning the hearts and minds of his subjects. As communist ideology loses its allure, Xi is enlisting religion to sell his program to the people. But it may not be that easy. Joshua Esler, a researcher who studies Tibetan culture at the Sheridan Institute of Higher Education in Australia, told me that Tibetan Buddhism has grown so popular precisely because it offers the Chinese something their government can't. Many Han Chinese, he said, believe that Tibetan Buddhism has retained a spiritual authenticity that is lost in China. They see Tibet as an alternative to the corruption, materialism, and environmental degradation that characterize life under the CCP. Any government interference in Tibetan Buddhism might alienate its followers, pushing them toward Buddhist leaders who secretly support the exiled Dalai Lama. As for Tibetans themselves, Sinicized Buddhism is unlikely to become popular anytime soon. Many of them consider monasteries that have too eagerly embraced Xi's program to be sellouts. But as the government ramps up its campaign, and as a new generation of assimilated Tibetans come of age, that might begin to change. After visiting Shangri-La, I went to the remote Tibetan town of Daocheng, where a young monk named Phuntsok showed me around his monastery. Without the Communist Party, we would not have the freedom of religion, Phuntsok told me as we walked through ornate chapels. He extolled the CCP's support for Tibetan Buddhism, and no wonder. Locals told me that the monastery, Yangteng Gonpa, had received substantial government funding. A freshly paved road snaked up the mountainside on which the monastery was perched, ending at a parking lot built to accommodate hundreds of visitors. A new welcome gate was being erected, and the tourism office promoted Yangteng as one of the area's main attractions. I followed Phuntsok up to the second floor of a chapel, where he showed me an exhibit celebrating the monastery's liberation by the Red Army in 1950. The space doubled as a classroom. A whiteboard showed me the faint outlines of a lesson on how monks can actively guide religion to adapt to socialist society. Though the monastery belongs to the Buddhist tradition of the Dalai Lama, Phuntsok didn't mention the exiled spiritual leader, whose name and image are censored in Tibet. Instead, Phuntsok praised Gyaltsen Norbu, a Buddhist leader who was handpicked by the CCP as a child to be the Panchen Lama, a position second only to the Dalai Lama. Many Tibetans don't recognize Norbu as legitimate. In 1995, the Dalai Lama identified another child as the Panchen Lama, whom Chinese authorities promptly detained and whose whereabouts remain unknown. When the 88-year-old Dalai Lama dies, Norbu will likely be tasked by the CCP to select his replacement, who will be raised under CCP supervision and expected to promote sinicized Buddhism. Westerners tend to imagine the Dalai Lama as a force for peace and human rights, but the position can just as easily be put into the service of totalitarianism. Excuse me. Gray Tuttle, the Tibetan studies professor at Columbia University, told me that the CCP is wary of any religious movement that isn't under its control. In 2017, the government issued orders to tear down the Larungar, Tibet's most popular Buddhist monastery. Thousands of residents, including many Han Chinese, were displaced from the remote valley where they had come to study. The official reason for the evictions was that the monastery didn't comply with safety regulations. The likelier explanation is that despite the government's initial support for the monastery, the CCP felt threatened by its success and the influence of its teachers. The CCP definitely wants to limit the charismatic power of any particular lama, Tuttle told me. The challenge Xi has set for himself, then, is to reshape Tibetan Buddhism without undermining its allure. Judging by the large crowds at Samsaling, he's succeeding, at least among some Han Chinese. Tibetan lamas possess the deepest knowledge. A Han woman named Jin Yi, who had traveled 400 miles to the monastery to meet her guru, told me. But devotees like her were considerably outnumbered by tourists, many of them dressed up as Tibetan pilgrims and modeling for photos, striking lotus poses, spinning prayer wheels, or staring in feigned rapture at Buddhist murals. Few entered the chapels, where photography was prohibited. Government-sponsored monasteries, like Samsaling, might attract tourists looking for a photo op, but lavish temples won't win over true believers. Our second article, from the business section. This is what life without retirement savings looks like. Many seniors are stuck with lies of never-ending work, a fate that could befall millions in the coming decades. Written by Elena Samuels. Roberta Gordon never thought she'd still be alive at age 76. She definitely didn't think she'd still be working. But every Saturday, she goes down to the local grocery store and hands out samples, earning $50 a day, because she needs the money. "I'm a working woman again," she told me, in the common room of the senior apartment complex where she now lives, here in California's Inland Empire. Gordon has worked dozens of odd jobs throughout her life, as a house cleaner, a home health aide, a telemarketer, a librarian, a fundraiser. But at many times in her life, she didn't have a steady job that paid into Social Security. She didn't receive a pension, and she definitely wasn't making enough to put aside money for retirement. Now, at age 76, she earns $918 a month through Social Security and through Supplemental Security Income, or SSI, a program for low-income seniors. Her rent, which she has to cover solo since her roommate died in August, is $1,040 a month. She's been taking on credit card debt to cover the gap and to pay for utilities, food, and other essentials. She often goes to a church food bank for supplies. More and more older people are finding themselves in a similar situation as baby boomers reach retirement age without enough savings, and as housing costs and medical expenses rise. For instance, a woman in her 80s is paying, on average, $8,400 a month in $8,400 in out-of-pocket medical expenses each year, even if she's covered by Medicare. Many people reaching retirement age don't have the pensions that lots of workers in previous generations did, and often have not put enough money into their 401ks to live off of. The median savings in a 401k plan for people aged 55 to 64 is currently just $15,000, according to the National Institute on Retirement Security, as a nonprofit. Other workers did not have access to retirement plan through their employer. That means that as people reach their mid-60s, they have to either dramatically curtail their spending or keep working to survive. This will be the first time that we have a lot of people who find themselves downwardly mobile as they grow older, Diane Oakley, the executive director of the National Institute on Retirement Security, told me. They're going to go from being near poor to poor. The problem is growing as more baby boomers reach retirement age. 8,000 to 10,000 Americans turn 65 every day. According to Kevin Prindeville, the executive director of Justice in Aging, a nonprofit that addresses senior poverty, older Americans were the only demographic for whom poverty rates increased in a statistically significant way from 2015 to 2016, according to Census Bureau data. While poverty fell among people 18 and under and people 18 to 64 from 2015 to 2016, it rose to 14.5% for people over 65, according to the Census Bureau's Supplemental Poverty Measure, which is considered a more accurate measure of poverty because it takes into account health care costs and other big expenses. In the early decades of our work, we were serving communities that had been poor when they were younger, Prindeville told me. Increasingly, we're seeing folks who are becoming poor for the first time in old age. This presents a worrying preview of what could befall millions of workers who will retire in the coming decades. If today's seniors are struggling with retirement savings, what will become of the people of working age today, many of whom hold unsteady jobs and have patchwork incomes that leave little room for retirement savings? The current wave of senior poverty could just be beginning. Two-thirds of Americans don't contribute any money to a 401k or other retirement account, according to the Census Bureau researchers, and this could have larger implications for the economy. If today's middle-class households curtail their spending when they retire, the whole economy could suffer. The retirement savings system of the United States has three pillars: Social Security, employer-sponsored pensions or retirement savings plans, and individual savings. But with the rise of less stable jobs and the decline of pensions, a larger share of older Americans are relying only on Social Security, without either of the two other pillars to contribute to their finances. This, by definition, means they have less money than they did when they were working. Social Security replaces only about 40% of an average wage earner's income when they retire, while financial advisors say that retirees need at least 70% of their pre-retirement earnings to live comfortably. Today's seniors are so reliant on Social Security in part because companies that once provided pensions began, in the 70s, to turn the responsibility of retirement savings over to individuals. Rather than defined benefit plans in which people are guaranteed a certain amount of money every year in retirement, they receive defined contribution plans, which means the employer sets aside a certain amount of money per year. This switch saved companies money because it asked employees, not employers, to take on the risks associated with long-term investing. This means that the amount people receive is more affected by the ups and downs of the stock market, their individual wages, and interest rates. In 1979, 28% of private sector workers had participated in a defined benefit retirement plan. By 2014, just 2% did, according to Employee Benefit Research Institute, a nonprofit. By contrast, 7% of private sector workers participated in defined contribution plans in 1979. By 2014, 34% did. The recession and economic trends in the years since have also worsened the finances of millions of seniors. Some bought houses during the housing boom and then found they owed more on their homes than they were worth and had to walk away. Others invested in the stock market and saw their investments shrink dramatically. Jackie Matthews, now 76, lost her investments during the recession, then had to sell her Arizona home in a short sale, netting only $3,000. She now lives near her family in Southern California, renting a room in a friend's apartment, and budgets her finances finances carefully, skimping on meat and never buying anything new. For many seniors, the answer to this lack of savings has meant working longer and longer, as Roberta Gordon is doing. Today, about 12.4% of the population age 65 or older is still in the workforce, up from 3% in 2000, according to Oakley. I met a woman named Deborah Bellew, who is 67 and works as a manager at a mobile home park in Palm Springs, California. She worked as a waitress for 30 years and often relied on government assistance as she raised her two children as a single parent. You just don't think about tomorrow when you're more worried about getting food on the table, she said. That means that today, though she receives money through Social Security, she can't afford a cell phone or a TV. Her rent is $600 a month. She works full-time at the mobile home park, despite aches and pains in her back and feet. Sometimes when she wakes up, she can't walk. But she says, I can't quit. There's no way I can live on $778 a month, the amount that she receives from Social Security. What can be done to help today's seniors and generations to come? There are two approaches, Prindeville said. Help people save for old age and make retirement more affordable. As for the first approach, some states have been trying to establish programs that help people save for retirement through payroll deductions, even if their employers don't offer any retirement savings accounts. The Trump administration repealed an Obama-era rule from the Department of Labor that would have made it easier for states to help people set up these plans. The second approach means that might mean expanding affordable housing options, creating programs to help seniors cover medical costs, and reforming the Supplemental Security Income Program so that poor seniors can receive more benefits. These initiatives can make the difference between having a home and some semblance of stability and not. Gordon in Corona is barely scraping by when I talked to her. A few months ago, later, she was much more stable. Why? She'd gotten off a wait list and had been accepted into the housing voucher program known as Section 8, which reduces the amount of income she has to put toward housing. She's still working at 76, but she feels a little more secure now that she has more help. She knows at least that she's one of the lucky ones, able in her older years to keep food on the table and a roof over her head. Now, a science article. Seaweed mining could power the future, by Moira Donovan. Seaweed is versatile. It provides a habitat for marine life, shelters coastlines, and absorbs carbon dioxide. But in the United States, scientists are setting out to see whether seaweed has another particularly valuable trick hidden up its proverbial sleeve, to act as a salty, slimy source of precious metals. Within the U.S. Department of Energy is the Advanced Research Projects Agency, Energy, ARPA-E, a scientific branch devoted to tackling challenging big potential projects on energy technologies. ARPA-E takes big swings and looks for big rewards. And so far, the agency has awarded $5 million to three ventures investigating whether seaweed can serve as a practical source of crucial materials such as platinum and rhodium, as well as rare earth elements including neodymium, lanthanum, yttrium, and dysprosium. These valuable elements, which can be captured and concentrated by seaweed, are essential to the green energy transition and to technology more broadly. Seaweed could represent an alternative to conventional mining and other prospects, such as deep-sea mining. Several years ago, Scott Edmondson at the U.S. Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, or PNNL, in Washington State, began digging into whether seaweed could store valuable minerals. He'd come across a paper describing how rare earth elements were accumulating in seaweed in polluted areas along Morocco's Atlantic coast and was struck by the potential. Reading about seaweed's natural propensity to sieve minerals from seawater sparked a wacky idea to test how far the process could go, Edmondson said. So he and other PNNL scientists ran an experiment to see if they could deliberately grow seaweed to take up minerals. The project, which is also funded by ARPA-E, finished last year, though they're continuing to dig into the topic. So far, the team's work suggests that seaweed can be processed to produce a carbon-rich component used in biofuel manufacturing and a second mineral component containing elements such as phosphorus. Underpinning all of this research are important unanswered questions, including why seaweed absorbs these minerals at all, and whether it can do so in concentrations high enough to be useful, and whether the elements can be pulled out in a financially viable way. The key to making all this work is figuring out how to extract metals and rare earth elements from seaweed without destroying it. For seaweed mining to make financial sense, the process needs to leave the algae in good enough condition to still be used for other applications, including as fuel, food, or a component in bioplastic production. Another crucial piece of the puzzle is finding the right spot to grow the seaweed. Despite their name, rare earth elements are not all that rare. These and other crucial minerals are present throughout the ocean in tiny amounts. Yet there are areas where they likely exist in higher concentrations, like downstream from large deposits on land. That's why we are examining whether rare earth elements are sloughing off Bokan Mountain in Southeast Asia and ending up in the ocean, and whether growing seaweed in a nearby bay can snag what runs off. Bokan Mountain is being considered for conventional mining, but if it works, seaweed extraction could offer a more sustainable alternative. Susette Pintius, a marine biologist at the Polytechnic Institute de Leiria in Portugal, co-authored a 2022 review paper on seaweed's role in the green energy transition. She says that seaweed extraction alone, if it works, cannot completely eliminate conventional mining for these metals because the demand is so great. Seaweeds can contribute, but they will not solve the problem themselves. Even though seaweed collection can't fully replace mining, extracting materials as they leach naturally out of the land, as they might on Bokan Mountain, algal mining offers a way to scoop up minerals that were going to be lost in the sea. Researchers never imagined that humble seaweed could become a vessel to capture valuable materials, but in this role it might support a more sustainable future. Metals have to come from somewhere, and extracting them is very destructive. It's worth exploring other possibilities that align more with our ideas of a greener world or a bluer world. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.